So you're going to put in the drums?
Yes. That's exactly right. Okay, that is what cool. I'm going to do. So I'll just cut it in after we finish this intro. Good. You ready? You want to tell people what's up?
What? What do you mean, what's up? What?
I'm on paternity leave.
Are you really? How do we know this? Did you file an affidavit? Nothing's true unless you file an affidavit.
There's no affidavit, but I'm recording this for the future, but that still means that the truth-telling nature of the microphone is still in effect.
Right, and the recording you're about to hear comes from the Summer of Love in 2011.
End of the summer, early September,
when we broadcast Inside the Black Box, a weekly program about science and technology, whose
your
motto is
weekly program.
Science Only Funnier. Well, it was ours for the Summer of Love in
for
2011.
For four episodes.
When we were only broadcasting at 10 watts, not 10 kilowatts. 10 watts. That means what? Like a half a mile? Something like that? Maybe a mile or two.
It was, maybe downstairs.
Because we were replacing the antenna, upgrading to 100,000 watts.
So you and I snuck into the studio and we quote, broadcast, unquote, four episodes of, you called them blackout episodes.
Right, because that was our state of mind at the time.
So here we go. 91.1 FM, 2011. Screw it.
Shut up and bring in the drums.
Consiliums.
With Pete and Charlie.
I'm Pete.
I'm Charlie.
The unity of knowledge.
That and a whole bunch of caffeine is what's going to get us through this.
What was that? Yo-ho-ho and a bottle of rum off the pirate top 10?
Oh, you're making some phone calls about that.
What, because I said pirate and rum?
I'm pretty sure that was a religious service.
Was that? Oh, okay. Sorry.
Are you saying pirates aren't religious?
Yeah. What are you saying? That pirates aren't religious?
You know what? I think that I would go on record as saying that pirates were, in general, not religious.
Look, if an alien species tuned into our show, particularly this three or four part series, we're not really sure how it's going to long.
The
blackout years. today's show is episode two of the blackout programming where Charlie Bennett, library group guru extraordinaire, and our chief engineer, Trent Alton, and I will chat about all things science.
I'm so pleased that you don't have anything for these shows.
I do. I got 18 pages of notes here. I just don't know which one we're going
to
do first.
Yeah, but then you have to ask me to come join you. And I like that very much.
Because you're way cool. That's the term, way cool. So,
you know, it's amazing. You calling me way cool, I think, actually makes me less cool.
It probably does. All right. But if you've got a question or comment about anything sciencey and you're listening to one of these podcasts, are people listening? Are we at 40,000 watts
today? I got a call the other
and
day.
And certainly the internet.
And the internet. Give us a call here if you're listening live. Wednesdays, noon to 1, 404-894-2468. And again, that's 894-2468. I actually called the wrong number when I was complaining about the website being down. And shoot out support person.
Pete,
that had nothing to do with
WRK. Pete lost his mind today. I think you put yourself
all right,
back
save
together.
That for the show. We're way over the 60-second promo. But
I'm out.
Charlie and his weird thoughts will be back next up on Inside the Black Box. Science Only Funnier.
This is Deborah Bird.
And Joel Block for Earth and Sky.
Listen to our program every day at midnight, 8:30 a.m., 1 p.m., and 5 p.m.
You'll hear about everything from sea life to star systems.
For quality, diverse programming,
stay right here at WREK Atlanta.
When every moment matters and a hand reaches out, when someone gives blood and a life is saved, that moment when heartbreak turns to hope, you're there through the American Red Cross. Every day, the Red Cross responds to nearly 200 neighborhood emergencies, and your support makes it possible. Use this moment to join us today. Visit redcross.org.
The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology.
I live on a street near the university. Are you getting this, kid? Don't know if I did. Oh, well. Oh, yeah.
I am always curious, Pete. Do you really think that the disclaimer protects you?
I was hoping. All right, joining me today is Charlie Bennett, library guru extraordinaire. What is your title over there?
I am the undergraduate programming and
programming and engagement librarian.
Undergraduate programming and engagement librarian. I talk about what we can do with students, to students, around students, for students.
Now, that sounds like something that you're not protected by the disclaimer for. You're also the faculty staff advisor to WRK Radio.
You can take the staff off now. I'm the faculty. I'm
faculty. Are you actually faculty? He's faculty, ladies and gentlemen. So if you're contemplating a lawsuit against WRAK or Inside the Black Box, Charlie Bennett, he's your man.
It's awesome. I will refer you immediately to GT Legal.
Who,
Yeah, I'm one of you now, man. I'm non-tenure track.
Yeah, that and $9 will get you a latte at Starbucks, ladies and gentlemen. All right, so what was the question you were asking when I interrupted you and forced you to give us your title?
No, I wasn't asking a question.
Oh.
I was just saying the disclaimer. I like the fact that this show has to protect itself because the stuff that pops up and the things that are said. When we get on a roll, you said Charlie and his weird thoughts. Well, I think it's Pete and Charlie and sometimes Trent
and
his weird thoughts.
And Bill.
And Bill. Yeah, where is Bill? Did you kill Bill?
Indeed, I did not. Make a good time. Pete killed Bill.
That's a good song.
No, Bill's just, he's taken the summer off. And then when we got to the end of the summer, we said,
extended the summer.
We're not really sure if we'll be broadcasting at 40,000 watts here on 91.1 FM. He said, well, why bother coming in? Bill is not engaged. He's not committed like we should be.
Yeah, we'll let that one go by. You know, the great thing about the 40,000 to 100,000 watts thing was last week we had Daniel Smith,
our chief engineer.
He came in here and sprayed engineering all over the show. It was awesome.
And we're still cleaning it up. No, he did a really good job. And we are grateful to Daniel, who's listening on a delay out in the lobby. And
oh, yeah. Did his face just change?
His face didn't change. But he'll hear us.
Yeah, he doesn't care.
Daniel, you did a great job. And he was
particularly
good because I called him up and said, Daniel, why is the website messed up? It's not his fault. And instead of saying, Pete, and using some expletives to tell me to be quiet, he didn't. He said, well, he's a faculty. They're that way.
Did he sort of work it out? I mean, did he give you the right names?
Patrick, I copied Patrick. I copied webmaster at WRK.org.
Webmaster.
Webmaster. Is that like, what was that? King Explorer? What was the title you wanted for the librarians at the Alexandria Library?
Oh, Warrior King.
Warrior King. I think we should, in fact, I'm making a...
Everyone should be a warrior king.
A little polystyrene badge that says Pete, Warrior King.
Speaking of Warrior King, here's a thing that's going to happen in October. I'm going to a conference, the Georgia Council of Open Media Organizations conference. It's basically the Georgia Library Association conference. And one of the nights, there's a thing called Battle Decks that I'm going to take part in. I've never heard of this before.
Is this legal in the state of Georgia?
I don't know. I was recruited. So they're going to give me a PowerPoint presentation that I have never seen before and a subject that I did not know was coming, and then I have to present.
And you've never seen the slides before?
I don't think I'm going to see the slides ever until, boom, they're up there. It's called Battle Decks. And I thought, oh, you know, well, now we're getting a little closer to Warrior King. I like this.
So
I might take a sword.
It was one of the security conferences I went to one time, and they did...
PowerPoint karaoke?
It was like Marketing Survivor or something. So they put a bunch of people down, and they had different companies come in for 24 hours and give them their marketing presentations about like their products.
Wow.
And they gave them like a bathroom break every 2 hours, and whoever could sit there the longest like won a nice prize.
So this is like the Senate and filibusters, basically.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's like keeping your hand on a car for the longest.
Right, yeah,
you can have
it's much worse.
All right, but I have to ask the question because you are a student of library science. There's that word.
And information.
And you threw down the gauntlet last week. You said, look, any science that can't do any better in terms of predictive capability than throw a dartboard is not a science. I claim it is. It's just in the early stages of development. So explain...
Early stages, Pete. 2,000 years of libraries.
No, libraries.
5,000 years of information.
Right.
The science should be there.
But this battle deck.
This is like the jetpacks thing.
Like,
where is the jetpack? Where is the library science?
Battle decks does not seem like library science. What is the purpose behind battle decks?
Entertainment.
Is that really it?
Oh, yeah. It's the awards dinner. I'm sorry if I didn't make that clear.
It sounds like a hoot.
This is an extracurricular activity. This is not part of my research.
But I think you could probably garner some scientific insight into the nature of people and how they communicate by just taking, you know, random 8 people and
mixing up their presentation. Did you just call me a sociologist? Is that what you called me?
I think I did. Is that an insult in your field?
Not if you're a sociologist listening.
But if you're a sociologist and someone who studies science, technology, and culture and a librarian, that would make you a polymath.
Oh, segue.
I've been reading, I got to find that in my notes.
Yeah, while you do that, let me say this. I've been reading some of the literature recently about, you know, the science community, and it's amazing to me the disdain that certain subjects feel towards other subjects, so much so that they create...
new words.
What new words were you thinking of? They
I
create
was thinking
new words.
Of, let me find it. It's Lovey or Boffin?
Oh, no, we'll get back to that. Yeah, okay. No, they create these food chains, like... You know, the physicists all think the chemists are silly, and the chemists all think that the
do we? I know a lot of physicists. They're pretty cool.
Okay, well, I'm saying in the literature, people really yes. enjoy denigrating, like, oh, yeah, sociology, if you like to read novels. You know, like, they throw...
Really? I don't see this in the literature I read.
Well, maybe I'm reading the popular literature as try to get into science. But these are supposedly people who do science.
Right.
Castigating and dismissing their, not colleagues... but they're co-investigators in the grand scheme of life.
Wow. So what's a typical, is this like in popular science or?
I'm sensing physics folks saying, everything is physics and everything else is just, you know, you're just dancing around, right? And chemists are like, maybe physicists have a thing, but no, it's all chemistry, you know, and the biologists are really just not getting down to the building blocks. And the biologists are like, are you crazy? Biology is, that's all life. What we're really talking about is how the English majors aren't really doing anything with their lives. And the English majors are all, well, we interpret novels. What does sociology do? They watch people.
Well,
I may have missed some connecting steps.
You make a very astute point, and that is that scientists maybe are purists, and they believe their science is the right approach, so they tend to be a little critical of other scientists, whereas engineers, we steal from biologists, physicists, chemists,
right.
and everyone else.
Right, you say, thank you
can.
So much for the information. Yeah. Now I can build something or put some
find an application
theory to an application.
For it.
Yeah, application, absolutely. Thank you. I don't know why that word just jumped right out of my head.
Well, because it has to do with a very interesting article in the National Edition from August 27th of the Daily Telegraph in London.
Adding a little class to the show.
By Catherine Rushton. Britain. She claims Britain is throwing away its computer heritage. And she's actually reviewing an article... a lecture by a Mr. Schmidt at the keynote McTaggart lecture at the Edinburgh Television Festival. I don't know what that is, but the Edinburgh Fringe Festival is way out. And I know we pick on Fringe Festivals, and I didn't know anything about Fringe Festivals until we had our guest, Mr. Lee, what was his name? Dr. It'll come to me. Tim Lee. I think it was Tim Lee. Tim Lee, who was characterized by the New York Times as scientist turned comedian.
Oh, that guy.
Yeah, so it is Tim Lee.
Look at that. Trent just wiped away that man's entire career. Like, oh, yeah, okay, whatever.
But I had the honor of opening for him when he was here in Atlanta, and we are appearing together doing Science Comedy, which is an oxymoron for another show, in Washington, D.C. in April. And he was going to the Minneapolis Fringe Festival. We're trying to do something at the New Orleans Fringe Festival.
I apologize. What is a fringe festival?
A fringe festival is exactly that. It's a it's an art festival where things are at the fringe of what is sane.
So is fringe replacing avant-garde?
I don't know.
And bleeding
edge? That's one of those humanities words,
I'm
avant-garde.
Sure it's kind of like Burning Man, except they're not burning anything. There's
Burning
just all that
Man? I don't even know what that means.
I don't know what Burning Man is.
Burning Man.
But in any case, out of the fringe festival came this really good an evolution rap that is now actually doing quite well in Soho, New York. And
I know what all of those words mean, but when you put them together like that, I have no idea
evolution
what you're talking about.
It's a humorous rap musical about evolution, so it's educational and entertaining.
A full-on show about evolution
is
doing well in Soho.
Tim Lee will be at the Minnesota Fringe Festival doing his science-y humor thing.
I think that's better than the opera in Klingon.
We did have the man who... was partially responsible for an opera in Klingon.
That's right. But didn't, if I remember correctly, the guy who invented Klingon kind of didn't want to talk about Klingon.
Sort of well, like,
to some degree. He was actually...
Oh, he just didn't want to say anything in Klingon.
Yeah.
Didn't want to do any
he's
translation.
He's like, I'm not your performer.
Well, he's a linguist, so he was actually kind of in awe of all the nerds coming in, like, learning his language and everything else. He's like, I can't believe they take this seriously.
Right.
Okay, yeah, that's a better explanation
of his
general feeling.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the point I'm trying to make is that fringe festivals, I think, often give birth to this education-entertainment hybrid. I'm trying to do it with humor and statistics,
at the New Orleans Fringe Festival, we may fall on our butts. That's all I'm saying.
Does it have anything to do with the project you're trying at the library when you do your workshop?
Oh, no, no, that's innovation and humor, right? Yeah, but yeah. Two other things, so it's kind of
educational. I like the stuff you're doing. I like what you're doing a lot because I feel like we're doing two steps forward, one step back on the styles of learning and styles of teaching.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I heard on the radio, so of course you know it's true, I heard on the radio that they've dismissed the multiple learner types.
What are the multiple learner types? People like that learn in different domains?
Auditory
learners.
Don't worry. Forget everything I'm about to say. But
meaning different learning styles.
Auditory, kinesthetic.
You don't know.
That's good. I like that. But was that a thing? Like multiple learning styles? Some people
like
better listeners.
Some people are better listeners. Some people are visual.
Yeah, visual, intuitive.
So someone declared, turns out, no experimental evidence whatsoever for that.
So that's interesting because Richard Catrambone of our own psychology department.
Oh, I met Richard.
With whom I collaborate on this innovation stuff has said that for years he never thought these inventories of learning styles were all that useful.
That was, I think, the main point of the story that, sure, some people get it quicker if they're listening. Some people get it quicker if they're mm-hmm. looking, or maybe if they're playing solitaire, who knows.
Right.
But do you really think that there are these groups of people that their brains are wired different?
I don't know. Richard says no.
Yeah, and the general thought is no. I mean, because, yeah, we're all different. But if you start saying, oh, people are able to learn better if they do these other activities, you start getting to a place where what you're basically theorizing is that some people's brains create
just messed up. You and I would be
look at that. I was about to make an actual point, an actual with scientific evidence that I had turned into. I was so serious for a minute there. Now I don't know what the hell I was talking about.
We were talking about. Well, it's kind of scary because Rich Felder, who's a chemical engineer, and I met him before. He's actually done what I think is very nice work on inventories to tell you if you're that kind of a learner. I am a visual learner. Which is bad because I think everyone else is a visual learner.
Didn't you just say that doesn't exist?
Right, but it doesn't exist, but it looks so compelling.
I think there must be. There's
got to be something to it.
Yeah, there has to be people who are better at one way or another of taking in information. It's just that to say that you have to
just
accommodate all of those people.
The probability that everyone is the same is very low?
Yes, right. I think what they say is it's not that critically important to adjust your teaching style to match their
learning style. Someone who is a better auditory learner does not mean suddenly that you have to make sure that, oh, no, the auditory learners are all being left behind because we're just looking at notes.
Right.
That just means the auditory learners have to whisper it to themselves.
Or they tend to convert it to a form that is correct. And it's reflected in their notes, actually. So if you take a visual versus a verbal learner.
The way the notes look?
Take a photostat
of the page.
I do everything with a diagram. And you can actually see this by looking at, if you give tests, a lot of times college faculty will have you, it won't be open book, but it'll be open notes. And they'll let you bring in one, two, or three sheets. And you get to make up the sheets. And we like to do that because, I give them most of the formulas anyway, but I force them to make up a sheet or two of paper that has notes because it forces them to organize it
in a way that's good for them.
And it's in a way that's good for them. That's just a side bonus, but I'll
I've seen some amazing note creation because the one page of notes, people will actually come in to the library where there are photocopiers and they have the little cutouts. They've intricately laid them out. Yeah, and they build the best page, and then they photocopy it all down to one thing. It's fantastic.
And it's tiny.
It's like
typesetting. They need a magnifying glass to read it.
Do you allow magnifying glasses?
I do. I said, like, I don't care what you do. You can fill both sides.
It's on the head of the pen.
You know, tiny little things. And if you need special glasses to read it, I don't care. Because I never give a test that would require more than memorizing three or four formulas that you can put on your thing, right? Put on your note sheet. If you put it on your thing, that may be a little...
Yeah, I was waiting to see what happened with that particular phrase.
I had some friends that used to, I guess they were the auditory type, but they like one of them would record the lecture and then they would share that with the others. But then when they listened to it, they would speed it up about 1.5 times.
Oh,
so it actually
nice.
Takes less of your time, but you can still understand the voice.
Okay.
So then they would switch off because they would have more time in the day because you didn't have to sit through the whole lecture.
Right. Right, so basically the conclusion is the empirical evidence suggests that it's not of critical importance that we change our teaching style, but there still may be something to the way people ultimately learn it.
The learning styles are what we're really looking into,
right.
If if people absorb information in one way or another better, they still have to then take that away and place it in context
make
and
it their
create
own, yeah.
knowledge. Yeah. And it turns out the best way to create knowledge, we're guessing, is that you throw a whole bunch of people. Excuse me. I don't know why I pulled back from the mic on that. You throw a whole bunch of people into an area and make them interact on that subject.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way you learn. You can get trapped in sort of a, hey, let's just talk a lot about what's going on and listen to some music. And then mm-hmm. next thing you know, you don't know anything. But if you
right.
if you work at it.
Yeah, studying together can be a very useful thing. All right, so back to this article from the Daily Telegraph.
Polymath.
This gentleman, Mr. Schmidt, was saying, there's been a drift to the humanities. Engineering and science aren't championed, even worse. And this is, yeah, this is from August 27th, 2011. They aren't championed, and even worse, both sides seem to denigrate each other. So you're right, they denigrate each other. They say either you're a lovey or a boffin, he said. And that would be...
You know what a boffin is.
I know what a boffin is.
What's
that's
a boffin?
A nerd. Right, that's the British equivalent of a nerd.
Or and a lovey is a vague and beautiful performing type character. Stephen Fry coined the term lovey.
Did he really?
He did.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
And when he was confronted with that knowledge by Emma Thompson on BBC, mm-hmm. he said, "Oh no!" He was horrified.
And who is Stephen Fry? I know Emma Thompson.
Stephen Fry is a polymath.
He's a polymath.
Now, Stephen Fry is a very, very smart, very erudite, singular personality in Britain. He was in Blackadder. He played Oscar Wilde in the movie Wilde. Let me see if I, you know. I can't.
I know you're
Trent.
About.
Okay, yeah. Trent knows. Trent knows. Stephen Fry. When was the last time you saw Stephen Fry?
I don't know. Something on the internet, I'm sure.
He's everywhere, right? Yeah. So if you Google Stephen
All right,
Fry,
have to Google Stephen Fry.
Yeah, you'll find him.
Absolutely.
He's on the show QI, which I think is brilliant.
QI?
Quite interesting.
Oh, okay. Is he one of these people that's on Wait, Don't Tell Me and NPR?
He
types?
Would be like that if he were in America.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
So, but the same gentleman, Mr. Schmidt, points out that what... he's flabbergasted that to learn computer science, it's not even taught as a standard in UK schools, and that Britain has gradually stopped nurturing its polymaths. That is a good word.
What is a polymath?
All right, I'm going to try to define it. A polymath is someone who has knowledge and capability in diverse fields, so science and art, something like that. So the most famous one that most people think of is Leonardo da Vinci. The one that I'm most familiar with is Arthur Koestler.
The Ghost of the Machine.
He was actually... Oh, no. Is he the Ghost of the Machine?
I thought Arthur Koestler wrote The Ghost of the Machine, didn't he?
So he wrote...
You've got the matchbox.
He wrote a lot of novels, but he wrote a book called The Art of Creation, in which he
You
claims,
always talk about this. Yeah, I just realized.
He claims that innovation and humor are essentially the same. So he's written technical books on that, and then he's also written lots and lots of novels. And he, in writings about him, has always been called a polymath.
So the experience of finding something funny is the experience of realizing that you've just heard something new?
Well, I think it's the process is the same. And when we do this workshop that are coming up in the library, our contention is that humor goes along some path of one particular domain of knowledge. And then suddenly it leaves that domain, you know, orthogonally or 90-degree turn out of that. And that is a very different, sometimes awkward experience. And if it's done just right, you laugh at it because that incongruity is funny.
Yeah.
So if it's a bad joke, the incongruity can be not funny and just awkward and creepy and you want to report somebody to a national database.
Right.
And then innovation works the same way. That suddenly you're thinking, you know, supposedly the urban legend is that the way we started burying power lines is... Someone was in a meeting and they were complaining about the fact that, you know, you get ice and trees and things fall in these power lines and what are we going to do? And the guy said, well, why don't you just chop them all down and bury them in the ground? That's not true, by the way. That never happened, but it's an interesting illustration.
Do people believe that, though? Does that feel right to folks?
People tell that story. That doesn't feel right, I don't. But that is how it happens. You just suddenly say, let's do something completely different.
But you have to be very lucky. Because a lot of times when you say, let's just do something different, people are like, well, we've never done that before, and there's a lot of reasons that might not work.
Yeah, and that's the constraint that keeps you inside the box. In fact, what we'll do is we're going to have Lou Left and Richard Catrimbone on the program once and actually talk about this. But if you think about designing something, give me something, anything. You're going to design?
How about a box?
You're going to design a box. Okay. So a container of some sort.
No, let's stick with a box,
yeah,
man.
I like boxes.
You mean like a cardboard box?
Sure.
Okay, but a cardboard box has constraints.
You are thinking inside the box while thinking
right,
about the box.
That's what I'm saying.
Do you know that Stanley Kubrick designed his own box and sent it, the design, to a box maker, and all of his archives are in a box that he designed, you know, over and over. I mean, there's many boxes, but mm-hmm. it's his design. It was exactly the kind of box he wanted. And one of them that he got in, he opened it, and there was a note at the bottom of the box to the, like, one of the makers from the, mm-hmm. the owner. And it said, be sure to follow all diagrammatic constraints. Customer is quite prissy.
Is Stanley Kubrick prissy?
I mean, I don't know prissy, but he's certainly.
He's exacting.
He's very exacting.
Exacting standard. So what did Kubrick do? What were the films he was involved in, right?
Clockwork Orange.
Eyes Wide Shut, Full Metal Jacket, 2001, Clockwork Orange, Barry Lyndon, Killing, Paths of Glory, Dr. Strangelove, yeah, the original Lita.
Okay. Gosh, he knows them all. Did he do 2010?
And Spartacus. No. That was Peter Hyams, and that was a mistake.
I like 2010.
Yeah, but compare that to 2001.
2001 was freakier.
It was definitely freakier.
It was more outside the box, that's for sure. 2010 gave me closure.
2010 was a story, and it was it was kind of beautiful how everything happened. But have you read the book? The book is amazing.
Was it also written by Arthur C.
Clarke? Yeah, Arthur C. Clarke wrote 2010 as a sequel to the movie 2001. They wrote the movie and the book simultaneously, like bouncing off each other. And that's why the book 2001, the monolith is like a television screen and it's transparent. Mm-hmm. It sort of teaches the monkeys. And Kubrick's like, no. They touch it. Evolution.
Okay.
Because that was better for the movie.
All right, but here's the deal. We have now another segue. And the segue involves, it's a multi-thread segue.
So. I wanted to hear you talk about the box, man.
Sure, probably take a break and then we'll talk about the box.
We haven't been taking breaks in these shows. Have you noticed it? Do you want to take a break? Do you believe the public needs a break?
Hey, there's a legally required break.
I thought we just have to do an ID.
You just say this is REC.
WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM.
There you go. Okay, well, now it's
done.
Right, so
now we're legal.
You only have to do the full legal ID.
Okay, now hold on. Don't
call
push
legal.
Your politics
all
on
right,
me.
Right. Call legal.
There's a couple people out there who are going to yell again if we miss an ID at the top or the bottom of the hour.
Okay. So one of the things I was upset about today is the website wasn't working right, and I wanted to put an announcement about the fact that we are interviewing Lisa Yazyk, a professor from Literature, Communication, and
Science
Culture,
Fiction, all right.
Who runs the Sci-Fi Lab project. She is also the curator for the Bud...
It's changed. The Seed Collection was the Bud Foote Science Fiction Collection, but now it is the Science Fiction Collection at Georgia Tech.
Which started with the Bud Foote.
With Bud Foote,
because basically he donated a lot of his books.
You know, Bud Foote taught me.
Did he really?
I took a science fiction class.
But in any case, one of the things she's going to be talking about Saturday at 1 p.m. in room 202 of the Hilton at Dragon Con, if you're around. That's not a call to action. It's purely informational.
This thing will happen at this place.
This thing will happen. And if you want to stop by, you can. We're not telling you you should or you shouldn't. We're not telling you anything about the price of tickets.
Skimming the line. Skimming it.
But in any case, I'm going to be interviewing her about a topic we've talked about on this program and on her show, Sci-Fi Lab, which is once a month here on WRK.
First Sunday of the month.
Science from Science Fiction.
Yeah, right? I love that.
And Kubrick is an example of science from science fiction, and it has to do with a recent lawsuit between Apple and, who was it?
Samsung. This is ridiculous.
About the iPad. But I love the response of Samsung. They said, look, basically the test for a patent is, was it obvious to one skilled in the art? You know, and if the information's already out there, you can't make that argument, right? That's a basic of the Patent Trademark Office. And they're like, you infringed on our patent for... It's a lot of details about the iPad, right?
I think it was an aesthetic patent or like a design
computer
patent.
Computer companies have lots of patents.
Yeah, but this was not about the
electronics.
This was the look and feel. Yeah.
Right, I believe the first one was Apple versus Franklin Computer over the way that desktop looked and the little garbage can icon and things like that. But in any case, what they did is they went back to 2001, Arthur C. Clarke, Stanley Kubrick.
On the Discovery.
And said, these guys are...
Dave is using them.
While the HAL 9000 is plotting their demise, they are watching video on basically something with the look and feel. So why do you think that's ludicrous? It's a long shot, but I'm loving it.
You like it as entertainment, but if that's how we're going to argue these cases, then I feel like copyright law has jumped the shark.
That's patent law.
Sorry, patent law and copyright law has jumped the shark.
Of course it has.
But has it?
He corrects me and then he agrees with me. What was that?
Okay, let me write that down. Patent law has jumped the shark. So what do you mean by that?
Well, originally patent law was so that people felt comfortable enough. And when I say originally, I mean like in the late 1700s.
Right,
so
that, to innovate.
Yeah, so inventors felt comfortable enough to... okay, you know, I'm just going to pause for a second, Pete, if you want to do an alleluia.
So is that Dan Smith holding the thing up?
Yeah.
Dan Smith has us up on the website. So Dan Smith is a gentleman and a scholar, a prince among men, a warrior king, so to speak.
You are a warrior king, Daniel. That's awesome.
But especially thank to Daniel for teaching us all about FM and AM last week. That was really good. All right, so patent law
was to give inventors the safety and security they needed to design stuff, to attempt to get it working, to build it and start putting it out there, and so that they would profit from the fruits of their labor.
Right, and
it was originally made...
For a short period of time.
It was originally made so that people wouldn't keep ideas to themselves.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. To give them that safety and security so that they could spread it out, you know? And then, I think it was 15 years, and I'm sorry that I don't have a number on this.
It was about that.
Yeah, it was a short period of time, and then it would sort of open up. It's like, okay, you've done that, now move on.
15 years nowadays for technology
is
a long time.
But certainly patent law does nothing like it used to. Right? It's not the same effect anymore.
So how is it not the same effect?
Because people are patenting things like I think in 1994 somebody patented movies being streamed over the internet.
I don't think you can do business process patents anymore.
You cannot. Yeah. You cannot. You can do process patents.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me say this, because this is something I've thought about a long time, and the first time I was ever
And Disney and Mickey Mouse. I'm sorry. Mickey Mouse. That's the big thing.
That's the copyright.
You should
stuff.
Not
that's
be able to
though.
Patent Mickey Mouse.
No, they have it copyrighted, but they have tricks where they can put it in the vault and then pull it out later, and then their copyright extends.
Yeah, I don't particularly like that. So basically you can't, make a new version of Snow White because they're like, for a limited time only, and then they put it back in the vault.
And I think you can track large reforms in trademark law right, 3 or 4 years before Mickey Mouse goes into public domain. If you go back and look, there's these big changes. Okay. 75 years, life of the creator plus 75 years, 155 years, that kind of thing.
So the Patent and Trademark Office, it's all Mickey Mouse's fault. That'll be one of our conclusions.
It's all Big Mouse.
So I think in principle patent law is still a good idea, but I think what has happened is that we patent too much. Most experts on patent law will agree that the patent literature is way overcrowded. It's particularly overcrowded in computer technology and bio
stuff.
Most
technology companies have a big war chest of patents, not because they want to sue someone over it, but because if someone's suing them, they will almost guarantee that person's violating one of their patents, too.
Oh, yeah, right. So now it gets to the point where, at least in
is
biotechnology...
mutually assured destruction of patent law? Is that what you just described?
That's exactly
what it is. If you come
exactly
at us, we'll get you.
But that's why big technology companies buy patents. Yeah. Why do you think Google just bought Motorola? They paid them billions of dollars for their patents.
Motorola has
a lot of patents.
Eight
patents they needed.
I thought it was because Google had finally decided...
But Motorola has a lot of other patents, too. but here's the thing. The reason you have problems is that many of the patents that are currently filed and approved... would not hold up in court. I think it's either the second or third circuit court of appeals that deals with that patent
Actually, it's like one district in like East Texas that everyone does their patent law cases through because they're known to favor like the person suing.
Oh, okay.
So there is an obscene number of patent law cases like in there compared to everywhere else.
But the thing is that...
it's like a stimulus package.
Yeah. The court has to determine if it's a valid patent or if it's infringing, but the person that says, okay, it's a patent, I'll put it in there... And this is in defense of patent clerks in the Patent and Trademark Office. These people are overworked, underpaid folks that are basically working there while they go to law school to get a degree in patent
just
law
like
and
every,
get out of there.
Every
and
government
make,
employee.
Right.
Overworked
and to make some real
underpaid.
Money. So, and I've dealt with these people directly on patents in the biotechnology field. And they're like, okay. They'll eventually grant this thing because these patent lawyers beat on them for months and months and years and years. And they'll grant something. They'll grant something that's reasonable, but... these things overlap. So the point is you make an invention in these crowded fields like medical devices or technology, you usually infringe on two or three patents and you have to license several plus you add your own part to it. So I think they're granting too many patents. And I wish I could just blame the Patent and Trademark Office, but these guys are swamped and they're doing the best they can. So the system might be a little bit broken. The idea of patent law is still a good one, but you're right. Given system instabilities, maybe they've jumped the shark, which is referring to one of the last episodes of Happy Days.
That's
where,
right. Thank you.
Where Fonzie jumped the shark in his motorcycle.
On water skis while wearing a leather jacket.
Yes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, he didn't do it on his motorcycle?
No, he was water skiing. Uh-huh. And the shark was coming.
It might have been good if he did it on his motorcycle.
No, but didn't he jump a shark tank in the parking lot of Arnold's Drive-In once?
This is how stories get started.
Okay, so we're misusing the jump the shark metaphor.
Didn't they make a new one? Or there was a new one that someone coined. It was like nuking the fridge from the last Indiana Jones movie.
I do think that, jumping the shark has jumped the shark, so there has to be a new one.
Nuking the fridge is...
Nuking the fridge is pretty
good. You'll have to explain that one, nuking the fridge.
Indiana Jones hid in a refrigerator while a nuclear bomb went off to save himself.
That's right. And the refrigerator was launched by the nuclear blast.
But it was like lead lined, so it protected him.
And he popped out of that. This was the last one with Shia LaBeouf.
Man, it was awful.
It was awful. That's just our opinion, though.
Can I tell you something awful? You ready? Something scary?
Yeah.
Indiana Jones 5.
Is it coming out?
It's happening.
Oh. Tell me. Harrison Ford's too old for it, though, right?
All I know is that it's the production is up on the newsletters and the various Hollywood Reporter kind of folks.
But, I mean, speaking of science, though, even a lead-lined refrigerator won't do much with a nuclear weapon, even if it's a tactical nuclear weapon,
as my brother says, there is no reason for any person to feel the need to do anything else if they survive a nuclear explosion inside a refrigerator.
You're done. They should just put a medal around your neck and
check
say,
it out.
Hey,
now you will do. In fact, I'm going to steal a line from my brother. He said he should just go into a diner and say, "I want a root beer float, but instead of a thing of vanilla ice cream, just put a cheeseburger in there." And they'll say, "Well, we don't do that's not root beer float." He goes,
"You will.
I just survived."
We will for you, sir. but it's funny, the misnomers in science, right? So I'm just barely old enough to remember my older sisters doing the duck and cover. Well, we didn't do the duck and cover thing. That sort of ended in the 50s, early 60s.
Oh, man, wait, no. Morning After in 1981, it came back. We were doing a lot of stuff.
Were you doing duck and cover after Morning After?
We were doing okay, go down to the basement. I mean, it was essentially duck. It wasn't literally duck and cover, so you're right. But it was essentially, okay, there might be a nuclear war, and you need to know these are the ways that you can, your body will be easily discovered after everything falls down.
But see, if the blast is big enough to knock the school building down, the radiation dose will mean you will never leave the basement if you don't want body parts to fall off on you. And that was actually, exposed in that movie. So, but the best one is from a cartoon called The Iron Giant. You ever see that one?
Oh, yeah, Brad Bird.
Is that the guy that wrote the story?
Brad Bird wrote and directed The Iron Giant.
The guy that wrote the story was married to Sylvia Plath.
Okay, wait. The movie script was written by Brad Bird.
Right.
The story was written by somebody else.
Yeah, and I forget the guy, he's a poet, was married to Sylvia Plath. But in any case...
His name was George?
Maybe. But it was a great story. I mean, at the end, this nuclear missile's coming toward the town.
Spoiler alert.
Okay. It's not going to ruin the movie if you see it. It's an excellent movie. If you want to see a good animated film with your kids that's interesting, educational,
avoid
insightful,
the call to action.
Pete thinks this would be a good film for you to see.
Nicely done.
So, I actually own it on DVD. And I don't own many films on DVD, so that's a good thing. But he's like, the bureaucrat's like, "Well, we can duck and cover." He goes, "There's no duck and cover in times like this." It's just, will you be incinerated ducking and covering or having a latte at the local cafe? I say, have the double cheeseburger. You don't have to worry about your cholesterol now.
Do you want to try and wind back this tangent? Do you think we can get back to where we started?
Let's wind back this tangent to
something. Are we talking about computer science and
so we're talking about this guy complaining that we don't have enough polymaths. And then we talked about Arthur Kessler, and then we went off in a rant. But it was actually all science-related. Right? There was science from science fiction, and we talked about us, at DragonCon interviewing.
I love the fact that there was a moment in American history when the engineers and the pulp writers were all on the same track. They were talking about the same things and designing the same things.
Oh, when was that? You mean 2001?
No. It was probably 44, maybe, 52, where the people who were writing the science fiction and the people who were building stuff, mm-hmm. the engineers, they were like right at the same spot, working on the same stuff, believing in the same future.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And then, of course, it split. Now you got the Matrix on one side.
But still, it's...
And you on the other.
The Matrix on one side. But I will say this, and I think Lisa will point this out when we talk about this again this coming weekend, is the scientists, the engineers, and the science fiction people, we like each other. We like to hang out and talk, right? I think we share ideas, and we're coming at it from a different viewpoint, but I think it's important. Trent, you're a geek, and you work in engineering. I mean, do you like hanging out with science fiction-y people?
I know plenty of people that read science fiction.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
What do you mean by science fiction-y people?
See, this is not what I'm saying, now it's a problem. I'm just saying that they were right there at the same moment. They were all working on the same things.
Yes, there was a convergence
thing. I would say if you talk about Philip K. Dick mm-hmm. and the scientists at the moment, they were not working on the same things. You know, they were not a bunch of biochemists all taking a lot of meth and trying to figure out why they felt like they were crawling with bugs all the time.
I don't know who did that, but it sounds like a party. That's all I'm saying.
Philip K. Dick spent, I think, a good 10 years of his life scratching the bugs that didn't exist.
Well, supposedly, Kerry Mullis, the Nobel laureate for the polymerase chain reaction, which is used in everything from CSI to biochemistry labs now, claimed he was on weed when he figured that out.
Nice.
A lot of people don't like us to say that, but that's at least his claim. I mean, this guy wears a Hawaiian shirt and shorts to, like, Nobel.
Is he like a Feynman? Is he trying to be Feynman?
I don't think he's a Feynman.
I think it was the CTO of Cisco. Cisco, the computer company. He had a famous quote that he forced everyone to stop taking drug tests in interviews because he said he felt that LSD was a valid problem-solving strategy.
There are many people
that
believe,
Time interview or something like that.
You know, people from Sandoz Chemical in Switzerland, a lot of people believe LSD was the future.
What year would have been that quote, you think?
It was in the 2000s.
It was recently?
Yeah.
Wow.
Maybe 90s? I mean, the company's
not. And inside I guess he's the black still getting box good in stuff. WREK Atlanta, in no way wishes to condone the use of illegal drugs. there's my disclaimer there. All right, so...
I still think your disclaimer will not save
I would agree. It's cute, though.
When I was reviewing the show, it turns out in the middle of the summer, we redid the science education standards that were last done in 1996. And I looked at a lot of different articles. The best one was actually written for The Scientist on August 3rd by, let me get this right, Megan Scutellari. She actually captured it best. And she pointed out the changes that they're making. And actually, she summarized it well. So if you want to read a summary, that's the one to read. But I am going to actually go to the report. And you have a copy of this in front of you.
Yeah, cool.
So the framework for K-12 science standards. And they admit this is not revolution, it's evolution. And the most interesting thing is the comments to Megan's article. So basically what they're saying is they want us to learn a little bit more about the basics of the scientific method. They want to apply it to some clearly delineated scientific areas, and they actually want to worry about application.
I found a wonderful quote in here.
What's the quote?
Before even what you just said, right, this article says, by the end of the 12th grade, students should have sufficient knowledge of science and engineering to engage in public discussions on science-related issues, to be critical consumers of scientific information related to their everyday lives, and to be able to continue to learn about science throughout their lives. Now, that last part, that's cool and nice, but being able to discuss science, you know, publicly and on a sort of popular level.
And understand what is good and bad science.
And, yeah, and to be critical consumers. Oh, God, I love that. I'm going to take that quote home with me.
But in response to what is claimed in her article, there were three comments left, and they look as though they're left by teachers. These were online at the scientist's website. And let me see if I can summarize the three comments.
Really?
Here's what one teacher said. This is by no means a new approach. A science teacher since 1960, I have seen such a push twice. It failed for at least two reasons. Teachers were not educated in this way. And that's actually a very interesting point. We'll come back to that. And the other is that professionals whose fields got what is perceived as a sliding of content of special interest to them. That I have seen firsthand.
Now, can you give an actual example of that? Because that could be anything when you say it like that.
Yeah, it could.
A sliding
and to be
of
honest,
content.
So basically, they're stressing what your research field is. And I'm not sure, having looked at the summary of the report, I'm not sure that's true. So I'm not sure I agree with this person, but this person is correct. This happens all the time. And all you have to do is sit on some National Academy of Science, National Science, you know, they get these panels together and they say, look, what should we be studying? What should we fund? And then later a solicitation comes out of it. And in my experience, it's very limited. It seems to be that someone says, well, we should fund this because this is the key to the future. This is what's most important.
I said,
you know, yeah. Bob, coincidentally, that's your research area. So the lesson from this is scientists, although they are much more objective than, say, politicians and businessmen, are people too, and there is some conflict of interest once
in a while. And what was the other comment about people are not trained this way?
I don't think they're trained that way. And I think the average teacher... in fact, who was I talking to about this? I was talking to someone about this the other day, that if you you look at a typical science teacher, they're taught as an education person first, so mm-hmm. they know how to make a lesson plan, but they don't necessarily know all the details of that particular field. There are exceptions, people that get advanced degrees in that field. And then if you look at a college teacher, none of them know how to teach, or very few of them do. None of them know what a lesson plan is. Ask your average college, what's a lesson plan? I don't know. It's what I'm going to talk about.
I plan on giving a lesson.
But they know the details of their field. And
yeah, and I have a response to that.
Hit it.
I just discussed science education with a dude who...
With a dude. You're sticking with a dude.
With a dude.
You're not going to give us any pedigree. It's just a dude.
I'm getting there. With a dude who went to GSU and Emory.
Right. He got Georgia State University in Emory. Two fine academic institutions.
Yeah, absolutely. He got an undergraduate in scientific criticism or critical science studies.
Okay.
Yeah, as preparatory education for maybe paleontology or geology. But then he veered and he went to Georgia State University and got a master's in education, their TEAMS program, which is supposed to be excellent.
Oh, actually, one of my chemical engineering students is doing that master's in education program, which is great because he's got a foundation in science engineering, and boom, they'll teach him how to do a lesson plan.
Exactly, right? So he did those two things, and he was gung-ho, and he's the kind of person who really could teach science to young people. You know,
yes.
Very cool guy, but very, you know, analytically minded.
Yeah.
He lasted 6 months.
Why?
Maybe, you know what, actually, I'm cutting him a little short. I think he lasted 3 semesters.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why that was 6 months in my head. But it was very short, mm-hmm. right? Because it ruined him psychologically, trying to teach high schoolers.
Oh, because they weren't interested in...
It wasn't anything as simple as that. It was, I mean, no disrespect, mm-hmm. Pete, when I say it was not like a movie in that way. It was not a... Here's the reason I had to go.
Right.
It was just at the end of that period of time that he was there, he left in the middle of the school year.
And it was just burnt out?
Or? It just burned him out. And I think that learning to do a lesson plan or learning to handle a class mm-hmm. is a much more difficult skill than being able to internalize a scientific method and maybe some statistics.
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely.
So maybe I have a point here.
No, I don't think I have a
point.
So even more difficult is... to try to teach it the right way with these basic principles of inquiry and data analysis.
Right, right. So
it's one thing to just regurgitate, here's what Isaac Newton did. That's easy to do. But to do this
you can read a
is
book.
So hard. And maybe JMC, who left a comment on The Scientist about Megan Scolari's article, is right. That's exactly what they're getting at.
Yeah, but I think that JMC implies that... teachers who were not educated this way and professionals who feels got... I mean, he's just... I'm saying he because I'm guessing that JMC is a he. I don't know why.
All right. So that brings me to the second of three comments by Dalel DuPont. This is his screen name. Who knows what
this DuPont?
Person is. No.
That's okay, you can't trust that.
Oh, Dale... Well, maybe he's working at DuPont. Okay, so this person addresses what you said. He says, gain knowledge based on observable evidence, in quote, this I would like to see. Demonstrate. So he is, his incredulity is dripping off his tongue. He doesn't believe we can do this.
Maybe that's
what your friend is saying.
Yeah, there's a lot of sarcasm in these comments.
Yeah, these people are bitter and angry.
I mean,
are you really just reading comments off the internet?
Well, these are comments about this article.
Right.
I'm not saying that this is what we should do. I'm just saying here's a small sample.
You're saying the comments on the internet on something are sarcastic. Of course they are.
No.
Well, not all of them are. Oh, well, let's look at the third one. The third one, he goes, this photo, the top of this has either been flipped. He said flop, but I think he means flipped. Or the teacher is a follower of the left-handed DNA school of thought. She had a DNA molecule, and I think he's referring to this alternative DNA.
You know what? Internet comments, there has never been a more wretched hive of scum and villainy. I would, if I could do something.
These were most insightful based on your previous comment.
If I could get in there and I could just change, if I could butterfly effect something mm-hmm. about, say, the internet, just removing that whole drive to comment is something I would do.
Oh, okay.
I really think that comments are bad.
But basically what these comments are saying is
I hope somebody clips that out and uses it to keep me from running for office.
They will believe it when, right, no sex scandal for you. Like, well, he claimed there should be no comments on the internet. I can't vote for him for senator.
He doesn't think people should be able to say what they mean. It's like, no, I just don't think you should do it on the internet in a flash. I think that I'm down with all those things. Like, there should be a breathalyzer tube on computers before you can comment. That every comment.
You would like everything to be moderated.
Yeah, yeah. That every comment you put onto the internet right. comes back to you in an email like a day later and says, do you still want to say this? That.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, you know, that every comment box waits. It's like you type it in and you say, there, now they'll know. And the comment box says.
Right, they should have sent that to me about my
come back.
Email message
there
to,
you
the,
go, yeah.
to the webmaster.
But that's a slightly different thing. But like a comment box should say, in 10 minutes, right. we'll ask you if you want to say this again, you know? Because
I am not staying on the website for 10 minutes, though.
Well, then you won't leave the comment, and
Trent
then life will be better.
To do, man.
And not because it's you, Trent, but just because every comment, really, really, every comments are mostly like CCs on email. Does it do anything? Does it help anyone? Does it make anything better? 99.9% of the time, I say no.
At least 98% of the time, I would agree.
What, that 1.9% is important to you?
But the margin of error is 3%. So we talked about that a few weeks ago when we talked about statistics. So in any case, what this report is saying, and you can actually get a free briefing of it if you go to the National Research Council. If you look up the Board on Science Education Framework for K-12 Science Standards, you can find this thing. You can get the full report, or you can buy the nice, neat, corrected version for like $38 or something like that. But I say get the free one. I'm looking at the
You should probably stop talking about free and money.
Okay, I should. but in any case, what they outline is excellent, but what they outline does a few things. One, it reflects the fact that modern scientific research is, they call it cross-cutting, but it means collaborative among fields. Right? Well, would you agree that modern science research is that way?
I think it has to be, right?
It has to be, absolutely.
Especially engineering.
Yeah, engineering. The other thing they added was the fact that they want to look at applied science and engineering, and they believe that you should take these things and revisit them and mix and match them at various grades and various topics as you go through, which is good. So you should integrate science and applied science. Those are excellent educational, pedagogical goals.
So a high school science teacher, maybe one of their main goals for the first semester is just to say, here are what fields of research are going to be, how they're going to be treated.
Right,
and here's how they mix. You know, here's how you can sort of preparing students for the possibility of I've got a biology problem, but there's going to be the sudden, you know, appearance of electrical engineering concerns,
right.
And to be ready for that, and to not feel like oh, people only know about one particular science or science is just stuff that smells funny that you got to stay away from unless you learn how to deal with the smell, right?
That sounds kind of one of my friends was an electrical engineering major, and his first class, the professor had drawn out a full computer, like schematics and everything on the board, and he circled this one little part, and he said, in this semester, you're going to learn about this part.
Wow.
Like, by the time you're done, you'll know about all of it. And I think my friend like immediately dropped electrical engineering. He's like, I don't want to sit through all this.
Did he say why? I mean, he doesn't want to sit through all that, fine, but did he say what the feeling of not wanting to sit through that was?
He was just like, this is much more low level than he wanted to deal with or something.
Right. He wanted the broad.
I think he switched to management or something, so God knows.
Yeah.
Well, that is the problem, that we're not engaging these people, right? And we talked about this last
He's
year.
He's got to manage somebody who knows that little part.
There was a report on changing the conversation, how we better engage people into the fields of science and engineering. And what we used to stress is, well, you got to know a lot of math and science. And now it's like, it's a creative, interesting thing. So for cross-cutting, the best thing – so here's the problem. The problem, and this is why your friend burned out, is it's really hard to do this. It's very, very difficult. And very few people have the ability to go look at things in disparate fields. And a good example of it was the other night I was watching something about Benoit Mandelbrot, who really pioneered fractal theory. Mm-hmm. and they talked about fractals. And fractals have applications in everything from designing computer-generated backgrounds for nature, because nature is very fractal. The biologists are excited about it because you can now explain the shapes of arteries and flower petals and all sorts of
stuff. He also used it for a bunch of analysis of the stock market and those
kinds of things. And there was a guy that talked about it, and fractals, by the way, you can write down a lot of math about fractal dimensions, or you can say it's self-similarity, that if you zoom in, you see the same pattern, and then if you zoom in again, you see the same pattern.
Right, right.
And best example was a fractal antenna, which, by the way, is very important to your cell phone and your smartphone and all these things. It's a way to get multiple frequencies into the same small antenna. And they actually showed one in silicon where they had little patterns of rectangles, and they zoomed in, and you saw the patterns over and over again. The cardiologists or the blood folks think that, you know, you have this oscillating thing, but then if you zoom back and lump the frequencies together, you see a similar pattern, and differences in those patterns might show you certain pulmonary cardiology-type diseases.
And when you say explain things like that, do you mean predict, or do you mean...
Model it correctly.
So
model it.
This is why it looks this way.
And Trent... I'm glad you chose the word model, because one of the things under this so dimension 2 is this cross-cutting thing, and I think dimension 4 deals with the applied engineering, dimension 3 deals with the areas you're going to work in. Dimension 1 was science and engineering practices, and one of them is developing models. The average person has no idea what a model is and why it's useful. They don't know how to make a model, because to them, model is a whole bunch of differential or integral equations.
I don't think that's what a model is to the average person.
So what does the average person think a model is?
I don't think I can answer that. I have no
plastic
idea.
Plastic airplane hanging from fishing line.
Someone wearing
clothing. Polystyrene, it's model.
I mean, when someone... that was a bad joke.
I think you say model, someone will immediately think of a fashion model or something of the sort.
Right.
Okay. So what do you think of as a model? Because you said model. What do you think of when you say model?
In a scientific sense?
Yeah.
Something that I can use to make simplifying assumptions on, you know.
Right, and understand, characterize, and predict the phenomena.
It's not exactly what's happening, but it's close enough that it makes it useful.
Is it a thing that exists, or is it a set of assumptions, or what is a model?
It can be just a bunch of ideas.
It's usually the way I'm thinking about it in my head.
Right.
It's the way I'm interpreting it.
Yeah, okay, that's actually a perfect answer. It is your picture of it in your head. And sometimes we can distill it down to a bunch of couple differential equations and integrate them and get numerical answers. But it doesn't have to be useful for you to understand that. Right? Why is he laughing at me?
This is Consilience with Pete and Charlie, a podcast about the intersection of science and the humanities.
The unity of knowledge. I always like to say that part.
You can find us on Facebook, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, and you can always get in touch with me or Pete if you look on Twitter and other social media.
And can't you also find us on Tumblr at peteandcharlie.tumblr.com?
Thank you.